what?
Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we are stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this.
From the garage of my erstwhile Philo sister in beautiful Highlands Ranch, Colorado. It is summertime, Colorado style.
Yep.
I am fully caffeinated. I have had it. And I don't even know if the guest is going to show up because I don't think we got an email back from the guy, did we?
I didn't get one.
Well, fra-la-la-la-la to that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, to Stephen Levin. We'll see if he calls in. Talking about the 10-second tag. But there's so much going on. I don't know where to start. It's been a tutorial in turmoil this week.
Mm-hmm.
I am fresh from the intellectual jousting at the Society for Research and Adult Development. That pissing contest got started with last night's debacle when I went over there. And the Hyatt in Denver is large hotel.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Texas Lodge. So you walk in there, and you go on the fourth floor, and you see maintenance people cleaning up and vacuuming. That's alarming when you think the meeting's supposed to start, and they're cleaning up.
Yeah.
You motor back downstairs to the safe at the front desk, and, of course, the file over, how can I help you? And she directs me to the Child Development Symposium going on across the street at the Colorado Convention Center. I said, it says adult here. Oh, they're all across the street. That's what they're doing, the registration. I went into this thing. I swear, I have not seen a place this big in my entire life. It was like a 900-foot ceiling. I must have walked about a mile and a half to go to this room, which I swear to God, I thought the whole place was empty. I turned the corner. It was like the one of those Dr. Seuss things when you have like all the people like, you know, standing on piles of things, throwing them down like in a bucket brigade. They're throwing T-shirts. They had to be 50 feet in the air. And, of course, they read my sheet. No, you got to go back to the hotel. So then my New Yorker came in, and I said, I don't think so. I think you have to make a phone call. Of course, the phone call was made. They said, all right, go back. So I go back. Now there's a safe there that's, you know, this guy, I think his name was Ernesto or something like that. And he's from Yonkers. So
of course.
He goes, listen, man, these cowboys don't know what the hell they're doing. We just take it over here. He calls this guy in his walkie-talkie. And sure enough, they're meeting on the fourth floor. But around the corner with no sign, with an empty registration table, with the door closed, and you peer into the little peephole, and there's about, well, I don't know, seven people sitting around this giant circle of tables and chairs. I went, oh, my. So I walk in. I'm about, I don't know, 45 minutes late. And here comes the ExoSafe to register me. And they're going over this thing. I can't even, let me have my book bag around me. That basically was about how to analyze, you psychologists can make anything boring. How to analyze,
hey.
Really, you do. You just.
I can make it fun, too.
You're just dead in the universe. That's your job. They do this
dead
like.
Dead to you if you don't knock it off.
Well, trust me, I'm far enough away you can't hit me if you swing.
That's
and it's this thing called the precision method. Have you heard of this thing, precision theory, where they work with cards and something? Anyway, they break down your life story by this, like, mathematical thing. 126 pages of this, and they're going to go over it page by page for the next 3 hours. I said, no. So I did the eco and fled out the door, and I sat outside at the empty registration desk and worked on my poster board for about 2 hours while SAPES inside straggled out to shake their excretory systems after being inside too long. And it got a little weird because it was like they thought I left. I said, no, I'm just not participating. And I watched the sun go down. It was nice. So that was my Tuesday night introduction to that crowd. Then today, of course, that led to the overnight under the covers fracking my poster board together, which I learned a lesson today that, you know, there's more than one way to Brooklyn. And I took the long road. See, I saw my daughter's science thing last week with these little poster boards, and they did a great job. They had with color, and they had pictures, and they had different color background paper and stuff. I said, I'm going to do that with my thing, thinking it's easy. Well, my sister here has a Mac, which is a nightmare. And then there's capacity problems, which resorted to the jump drive. And then, of course, there's printer problems, so I had to go to Kinko's. And then I had to go to Kinko's early in the morning. And then, of course, Kinko's had no ink in their color printer. So I had to go to Staples. I had to go to Staples and get ink for the color printer. Otherwise, I had to go to a different Kinko's the other side of town in bumper rush hour traffic.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. And I didn't tell you about the parking ticket last night and all the other fun I had here. Yeah. So anyway, long story short, I had to make everything happen at Kinko's. Come back here by 8 o'clock. Now, the thing starts at 8:30, and I was shot. I was shooting for 10. So I'm sitting here with, I didn't even know how many pictures I had to cut out and organize in this thing for 2 hours with the glue and the whole thing.
Right? So arts and crafts.
The arts and crafts. Yeah. So I pile into the car, and then the car is another fiasco because they upgraded me. You know when they upgrade you at the car rental place, you go, good, you upgraded me. Oh, no. They charged me for the upgrade.
Well, you didn't ask for it. Why would they do that?
I don't know. We're going to have to argue that one. Why did we argue the parking ticket I got after 6 o'clock at night?
Oh, brother.
Yeah, welcome to Colorado. That'll be $200. So, anyway, it was weirder. It was weirder than I could possibly put in the words because the fatigue factor that had been accumulating got to laughable about, you know, last night because I'm sitting here clipping pictures and all of a sudden, the computer decides that's enough visual memory for youth for the night. I had to put everything on the jump drive, which was, for me, like a seal with a ball on his nose to get that done. But anyway, I got over this thing right at lunch. Oh, you're just in time for a business meeting. Hello. Now, these guys have about 350 members online, and about maybe a third of them go to these conferences, right? This year they had maybe 50 people. If it was, not what am I saying? Maybe there were 30 people there. And it was just very kind of sedate and almost people getting up and leaving the building. Because the way they did it was they sit in a circle and every group that goes in every 90-minute cycle does like a little 5-minute spiel and says, join me at my poster for more questions. And you do like a little commercial for your poster. And then you stand by your poster like an idiot, like the Pie King, and wait for Sapes to come over and poke you and poke you and poke you. So, of course, you know, I'm like the only clinician, the only one that's from the outside of the psychology realm, really. And it was just, you know, a square peg in a very, very, very round hole. And it went okay. I guess it went okay.
Yeah?
But it was just very, you know, it was funny. They were very interested in chaos theory. The psychologists were. And
yeah,
using,
well, I am too.
Well, to describe adult development. They're into the stages and the all these different models.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It had a lot of sort of tired academic wind blowing in there, but it was one left, and I met a couple people that were decent, you know, and I definitely did a good job of stumping for Soma Day tomorrow, which was I did a commercial about every 5 minutes. So I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. They finally located the one and only Tim Graves.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the Philo was flying extremely low. He's, you know that Flintstone when they're pedaling and keep that whirly bird in the air?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of where Tim is right now. Just about keeping the whirly bird in the air.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm going to go up to Broomfield and I'm sure the snow will be gone because that's the nature of the beast here. It snows one day and then it's 55 degrees the next day. So, yeah, 1 to 5, if you're in the Colorado listening area, 1 to 5, Mountain Daylight Time, we'll be in Broomfield. You can go to somerspace.org/somaday.html for all the festivities. It's a free, because no one will pay me to do what I do. See,
that's the point. Well, and that sucks because what you do is actually valuable, even though people don't know what you do, so they don't think it's valuable because they have
no
clue.
They don't know.
They don't know.
Even enough to ask the questions of why.
No.
I mean, the stuff we got into today with these people came over to the thing, and I'm profiling them, and they were like, I mean, they're pretty smart fish. They were like, how do you know that? I said, it's written all over your face. He's thinking, Philo, what? How do you know? I said, because it's right here. I'm pointing to this poster, which we have to take a picture of to get on the web, because it was, it's like the typical ADD poster. One guy walks over, he's a junkyard Philo, and he goes, I need all this explained. It was like, he did some really wacky stuff with, he did like an analysis of how peddlers set their prices in Brazil. Hello, do we have more obscure? He's saying I'm obtuse. I'm talking about like how someone's moving and stuff. So I don't know what this guest's going to call. We got nothing back, right?
We got nothing back.
It's amazing.
Wait, there it is.
A stunning development. You know, every time we get into this mode, the guy just calls in and surprises
us. That's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm shocked and amazed. Oh, we're gonna
I'm very happy. All right, you know what? I will find the horn.
Good God, consider yourselves fortunate that you have John Adams to abuse, for no sane man would tolerate it.
John, you're a whore. We've heard this before. Now, for God's sake, John, get out.
I say both, yes.
No.
Both, yes.
No.
Both
very good.
Are independent. Good God, consider yourselves fortunate that you have...
How's that?
Right. Oh, my God. All right, put him up. Let's get him on the air. I have no
all
idea
right.
Why I hit that.
Here we go.
All right. Joining us, if I see the thing click. There it is.
Hi, this is Steve Levin.
Yes, Steve Levin is on the air. I don't know. Where are you calling from, Stephen?
I'm right outside of Washington, D.C.
Oh.
All right, great. Okay. Well, I'm up high on top of the mountains today in Denver for a conference out here, and we got bombed with a little snow tonight, so it was went to Wonderland driving
yep.
back on April 1st. Oh, it was great. The snow's like powder here. They didn't even shovel it. They used a broom. It's not like back east where everything makes you miserable. So, Stephen, we're going to get to your expertise here in a second, but I got to share with you, you came up spontaneously in a conversation today with a bunch of psychologists. Now, I don't know how often that happens to you. If psychologists in a remote city are discussing your work, but they were trying to understand tensegrity in biological systems that have self-awareness. So they were talking about people in comas and stuff, you know, and how their bones break down and, like, you know, things like that. So I said, okay, I guess he's in the wind because I heard your name. And how do you know he's my guest today on the show? So we might have some people in the hotel in Denver tuning in here, listening to this tonight just to get an answer from you. So do you have any experience of people in comas? Do their bones decay any faster or any differently than someone that isn't?
I have no idea. I'm an orthopedic surgeon by training.
Okay.
And I'm retired now from that business, and I just do this, but I don't know anything about comas, and I can't imagine that psychologists or psychiatrists would know anything about what I do.
Oh, they were very interested in you, because the psychologists that I was with today, they study adult development, and most of them were studying aspects in terms of stages of development and how someone starts to break down and lose their form, so to speak. And, you know, the typical geriatric concerns about the broken hip things and all those things. More physical stuff, but they were talking about how someone would break down on an emotional level, of course, because they're psychologists, and how that would affect them physically. And does tensegrity speak to that? So it was funny how you just kind of came in. I was in another conversation. All of a sudden, I went, what? What's going on over here? And I sort of became the tensegrity police there for a minute. But from our standpoint, our curiosity about your work is twofold. One is that Professor Val and I are card-carrying woos, so we like Castaneda, and you don't,
yeah.
On your website at least. So when you first got into this modeling, as an orthopedic surgeon, of course, it has that tensegrity, if you guys don't know about it, it was something that started out basically in the realm of architecture and then evolved into a whole bunch of stuff, and I guess maybe mid-80s or so is when it sort of caught on in the biological realm. And what Stephen's been able to do is look at it in living systems, specifically human beings, and understand that the way that we're built, everyone talks about, like, if, especially in orthopedic circles, oh, I've got a bad back, I've got a disc problem. It's a compression thing. It's a compression on the nerve. And that compression model basically says gravity's trying to squish you down like a beer can. And you, in basically, you know, pushing all the hard structures into all the soft structures until you just, you know, you have compromise. And tensegrity says, no. Your system is built to distribute tension around and adapt and absorb forces and maintain its form. So it's the tensional elements that are active and in play, and the other stuff is passive. So it's like it's almost counterintuitive. So how did you, with someone with their orthopedic surgeon's training, how did you ever get this idea into your head?
Well, it started actually with me in the mid-70s. I was a cutting orthopedic surgeon at the time and specializing in spine surgery. And I just didn't accept the model that was out there. So I went down to the Smithsonian, which is, as I said, I live right outside of Washington, D.C. And I went down to the Smithsonian and studied the dinosaurs. And, you know, I spent weeks down there studying the dinosaurs and the large, now extinct mammals of the Ice Age. And there was no mechanical way they could exist. And I was sitting on, there's a lovely mall, if you've been in Washington, and you sit on the mall and watch the pretty girls run by, and directly across the mall from the Museum of Natural History is the Hirshhorn Museum. And in the outside rotunda of the Hirshhorn Museum is a sculptor piece by Kenneth Nelson, who really is the originator of the tensegrity concept.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a 60-foot-high tower of poles that are sort of suspended within this tension network. And I said, this is my model. And it was one of these aha moments. And from then on, I worked sort of backwards. But when you get into, I studied Snelson and I looked at that model. I called him and finally then moved it towards Buckminster Fuller, who developed work on top of Snelson's work. And so he combined the two and then I said, well, this is a model that applies to biologic systems, and it went from there.
Wow. See, a lot of people don't know the backstory between Snelson and Bucky. He was a student of his, I think, an architectural student of his. And originally, Bucky gave him full credit for it and eventually kind of commandeered the word and put it into synergetics, and away he went. And one of those little backyard deals that happens a lot in science that nobody hears about, you know, the Alexander Graham Bell kind of a thing. He's, you know, one of these pioneers in the sense that to be able to look at a structure and to see things, and we talked about it today at the meeting, in terms of their fractal design, where you have the same basic pattern on different scales, repeating and integrating and being able to distribute their information, almost the way you look at biological systems from cells to tissues to organs to systems, it's the same basic pattern that you see, and your video on your website demonstrates it really clearly over there. No, people don't understand. How would they have, from a layman's standpoint, how would they have an experience of their body's tensegrity just doing everyday activities, walking, running, whatever?
Well, I think the best way to describe the difference between the tensegrity model and the present compression model that's out there is it's the difference between a wagon wheel and a bicycle wheel. The wagon wheel, you're really putting all the weight on one spoke from the hub to the going through the rim, and you compress that one spoke, so the full weight of the wagon is on those. If you've got four wheels, it would be four spokes, but thinking about one wheel only, it would be the full load is bearing right directly through that one spoke, and you could actually remove the rest of the wheel and it wouldn't make any difference because it's not doing anything at that particular instant. And what you do is then you vault from spoke to spoke to spoke, compressing it so it has to be strong enough to take these heavy loads. In a bicycle wheel, you really are hanging by these tension wires in this wheel, and it distributes through the whole wheel. And you can replace those wires with guitar strings. It wouldn't make any difference. It's the tension element, not the compression, so they don't have to have any compression strength at all. And you distribute it through the whole wheel, and all the spokes work all the time. So what you're trying to do is balance out all those spokes. So you have a continuous of the tension elements and a discontinuation of the compression elements. The compression element would be just the rim and the hub, but the hub is suspended within this tension network. Hmm. And what I did is say, well, that's the way the bones are. So each bone is really the hub of a tension network, and it fits into the hierarchical system. And you're right, it is hierarchical and fractals, and they all fit into one another. If you want to get into the psychology end of it, where you are, you go right down to the biochemical level. And Donna Ingberg, who is a professor up at Harvard, started almost, must have been close to the same time I did, working at the cellular level, and he still does a tremendous amount of work at the cellular level. I started at the organism level and worked down to the cell, but they all integrate with one another.
Well, all right. Well, this is, it kind of gets right up to the, and this is what we're saying. There's a consensus thinking, or we tend to call it the Mu view, where there's the lion's share people on the bell curve have a kind of conventional way of looking at stuff. This model, because of its counterintuitive nature, it takes you to this metaphysical level of thinking of things, because there's no outside way of explaining something in this sense that you gave two perfect examples there. But in order for the person to accept it, it's some of those things where the first-hand experience actually matters more, because you're taking something that is already whole and you're giving it an interiority, where the other models, the compression models, they're from the outside in, and you can just find a line of force and sort of kind of find the soft wall, so to speak. So I guess I'm, in a roundabout way, I'm saying we're getting close to discussing an intelligent design here, which doesn't mean God, doesn't mean religion, but it means that there's an infrastructure in here that is being slowly decoded. Do you have any conversation or any kind of backyard discussions about the fact that this might be one of the keys to looking at things from a standpoint of intelligent design as a systems thinker, not as a theologian, but as a systems thinker?
Well, what we're talking about is that biology is physics, and the laws of physics apply. And so that you're dealing with a mechanical system, essentially, and physical laws. And I don't know who made those physical laws, but those physical laws are universal.
Right, but when you find something like that, wouldn't that suggest that there's an infrastructure, that there's an inborn self-organizing pattern that is basically peanut butter all over the place? So any living system you break apart, you're going to find, you know, this signature at its heart mechanically. You're going to find it there if the system is going to be able to evolve. Otherwise, basically, it's almost like a survival value. The more tensegrity you have, the more complex your tensegrity is, then the more environments you could adapt to. That would be my sort of like working assumption of it. Is that accurate? Or
It's accurate. It's a self-organizing system. So it starts at the very basic organic chemistry level and works its way up just because of physical laws of closest packing, where you're just jamming everything together into one space. So, you know, like bees don't design their beehive. What happens is that a bee gets in there and he's trying to fill a cell with wax or honey or whatever, and a bee next to him is trying to do the same thing, pardon me, and they're all pushing each other, and what you get is this hexagonal pattern. It has nothing to do with design. It has to do with physics. So that one guy's pushing against the other, and the conservation of energy requires that space to be hexagonal.
Now, hexagonal is an interesting term, because it goes to my next point, which came up after lunch today, actually. I feel like I'm in a parallel universe. We're living in reverse. William Calvin's work in neurophysiology in the brain, he talks about a cerebral code that uses this hexagonal model for the way neurons communicate as a network, which is another form of tensegrity, which gets into a whole different discussion. And there's another geometrical marker at the level of the brain that suggests that, just like Bucky Fuller talks about in synergetics, that there are these shapes in geometry. that have properties that allow them to basically hold that energy, like a quartz crystal can hold energy, things like that. Do you see in your work, and you went from the organism down, how a person individually can become more aware of this through physical activity? Is it something that they can entrain, and they can become aware of it through guided meditation, or is there something physical they could do to understand the rhythm of that, or is it just something that they have to just below the threshold of being conscious of and just accept that it's there?
Well, there's a whole school of dance done by a fellow named Laban. In England, he's long since dead, but the school still survives. And they talk about the 10 sacred structure. Actually, talk about the icosahedron, which is what I use as the basic finite element structure that builds. You start with the icosahedron and build from there. So in two dimensions, it would be the hexagon. In three dimensions, it would be the icosahedron.
You okay over there, Stephen? We had a coughing fit last week on the show. It was mine, though.
Yeah,
sorry, we didn't need to record that yet. But and Buckman before.
Well, it's hay fever time around here. We got a lot of.
We'll have to send you the link to our Naked Summer video about hypersensitivities and getting your thymus up to snuff. But the Bucky Fuller focused on tetrahedrons as the building block in his system, as the basic thing, the way the body can absorb the force.
Right. Fuller focus on the tetrahedron because it's the strongest structure and the minimal structure. But once you get into biologic systems, you have to think of closest packing in three dimensions, and the one that does that naturally would be the icosahedron because it has the largest volume for surface area and the most round. So it most approaches of what a cell looks like, and so it fits structurally the best.
Right. Now I was lucky enough that I was at a conference 2 weeks ago. This is like conference month, and we were fortunate enough to have the great and powerful a man from Chicago that works on biotic systems. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. I'm trying to think if you would even know of him. Wow. Jeez, I'm trying to think. I have like a million names in my head that I could link to them, but none of them are popping in. Staying in my mind here. It'll just roll around the back of my head for a second. And he was discussing the rhombic dodecahedron as it relates to heart structure, and it was interesting to watch the geometry of this evolve as he went through from the basics. Tetrahedrons on up. But when you got to the heart, as he called it, a biotic attractor, and its job is basically a rhombic dodecahedron, a 12-sided structure here that can actually take voltage in and distribute it to the rest of the body. And he gave a great demonstration of it that I could send to you because it's kind of complicated. But it just made it very clear to me that these geometrical shapes are real. And they're not abstract, and they seem to have some biological reality to them.
Yeah, well, the rhombic dodecahedron would be an unstable structure because it has square faces. Mm-hmm. So you need a fully triangulated face to be to remain stable. So the icosahedron would oscillate through several phases, and this is where you get the rhythms of life is through the oscillations of the icosahedron. But what its expanded state would get it to the rhombic dodecahedron.
Okay.
And as it contracts down, it goes through the icosahedron phase and then down to another phase, which is another unstable phase. So it just keeps oscillating back and forth through the system. So the guy's almost right, but the basic structure is really an icosahedron. And the icosahedron, the tensegrity icosahedron, is the most stable of these structures and is a natural oscillator. So some of the beats of the heart, for instance, it just mimics exactly what an icosahedron does.
Okay. Well, this is, like I said, we're probably off on an island now where very few people visit. And I want to kind of steer back to something people might be familiar with. The way we kind of came into contact is interesting because about a month ago, I guess it was, Alex Rodriguez was injured on the Yankees and had hip surgery out here in Colorado, actually. And Hector Cibeli is the man's name I was thinking of before, if you didn't mention him before. He studies biotic patterns and very, very detailed math, so I'll just leave it at that. I'll send you the stuff later.
Yeah.
But our contact came on a much more mundane level, A-Rod's hip. I wrote an article on New York Baseball Digest about tensegrity and how we can't pay attention to just the hip. We got to pay attention to how the hip communicates mechanically with the other three limbs, and if they just focus on rehabilitating the hip at the exclusion of the other three structures, you're going to see compensation all over the body because that's the way the nature of tensegrity works. And, you know, you commented on there, you know, oh, hey, I got a whole thing over here called biotic tensegrity. Make sure these guys know about it. So the baseball guys were curious as how you found out that article was even up there. Do you have a search engine, the kind of thing that just kind of finds anything that says tensegrity on the web and tells you? Or how did you find out about that article?
Google. Yeah, Google does this. You can put up you put up some keywords in Google, and they will search the word for you and give you a tickler. And so that's how I found that.
Oh, okay. So you do that often? You just see who's out there writing about tensegrity, and then that pops my name. Wow. Okay.
Exactly, and if there's something that interests me, I'll send you a little note.
Yeah, it was very shocking because I've known of your work for, God, it seems like about 15 years now, that I've been looking at your model and how it relates to some of the other things I've learned, and in terms of the way the system reorganizes and then some of the nonlinear stuff I've learned, like I mentioned Cibeli's work, it's interesting for me to get your perspective because you still maintain the physical, mechanistic almost like a literal definition of tensegrity, and anything that comes across, I guess, your radar that sort of goes off of that trail loses your jurisdiction. It's like that's not your area. Almost like when you were pursuing your guy there, architecture guy. And my guy, the Holy Grail, was Carl Kribram, who's down there actually at Georgetown teacher now, big brain researcher. And, you know, when I found him, I thought I was going to get nothing but holograms and lollipops. And he's a hardcore brain scientist. He could sit there and say the universe is a hologram, you're a hologram. And it's very abstract to say that to somebody, but when you actually get to talk to him, he will not go into any abstractions. He's a dying-of-wool scientist about it. He leaves that to David Bohm and the other guys to do. So you seem to be very there's narrow and broad definitions of tensegrity. You're focusing on specifically on living systems, and then within that context, I guess mostly humans. Do you see the field in terms of the way, like we talked about A-Rod, do you see sports medicine moving in this direction? Do you see anything to do with human performance moving in this direction of teaching people how to use tensegrity systems for either prehabilitation or for recovery?
Well, yeah, there are people who are in sports who are very much into biotensegrity. Scott Sonnen, who is he was an Olympic coach and does a lot of work in martial arts. Teaches it worldwide at his gyms, and he uses tensegrity as the basis for a lot of the martial arts. And the yoga people have picked it up, and a lot of the osteopaths are using it, and it's being taught, the principles of it are being taught in several osteopathic schools in the United States, and particularly in Europe, many in Europe. So there are people who are picking it up and using it in sports quite a bit.
It's one of these things to me. Once you have this awareness, and maybe it's something that has to happen to you directly. You would happen in the course of getting frustrated with the models you were taught. Very similar to happen to me in my chiropractic training. They taught us a dead spine model, as they used to call it, that had no skull. First of all, had no intestines hanging off your lumbar spine, ruining your curve. And they just deleted everything that didn't apply to what they were doing, and it was a very cartoonish version of the mechanics in there. And And the more you attach the rest of the skeleton, first of all, and then put the fascia in there and put the nerves in there and have this thing being animated, the more you realize that there's no way XYZ is what's happening here. This is a cleaned up, homogenized version of what's happening. And you start to realize that the mechanics were derivative of some of the other dynamics that were going on, especially when you start talking about how the system is growing and changing during development in terms of its complexity, in terms of its infrastructure, too. So how much of this work has gotten involved in some real kind of nooks and crannies? Like, I always think about it, that if pediatricians and obstetricians were studying this, what they would think about developmentally with kids as they assess, because they usually do a very third-person way of assessing a child's development, the milestones, the chart, the growth chart, all that stuff. And there's no sense of individuality with it, where tensegrity systems are very specific to the individual, even though there's a universal pattern, especially when you're dealing with childbirth problems, pregnancy problems, things like that. Now you have two tensegrity systems working within each other during a pregnancy process and a birth process. How much of this work has gotten into the actual nuts and bolts of delivering babies? Because if they understood the dynamics of it, a lot of the stuff they do to prepare the mother for birth would go out the window, maybe with the baby in the bathwater. I don't know. Has you ever gotten any feedback from those guys?
Well, indirectly I have. You have to understand that the baby structure, the infant structure, develops in response to the forces being applied to it. And just as the beehive develops because of the forces of external forces pushing down and internal forces pushing up, the infant develops, the fetus develops in utero because it's being crushed by the walls of the uterus and is pushing out to defend itself, to keep itself from being crushed. And so it has to develop into the most energy-efficient structure that's pushing back in all directions. And through the combination of physics and genes, you end up as a baby. And the remarkable thing is that that baby can then be pushed down through the birth canal, squeezed out like toothpaste out of a tube, and then come out and live in a completely different world where the crushing forces is considerably diminished, and it can expand out. And under normal circumstances, you would say, well, Jesus, things should just then blow up because it's not being pushed anymore, like taking a balloon that was filled, that was blown up underwater, and then taking it out of the water, and it would expand out. It doesn't do that, and that's because, again, the tensegrity structure pulls both in and out at the same time.
Wow. I mean, it's very, to me, I know this stuff, and it still seems counterintuitive because your tendency is to think, you know, open chain, long chain, you know, those kinds of very linear ways of thinking, the way force goes through the body. And this is it's almost as if, like I said, it's a cascade. There's lines of force, and then there's almost like there's tributaries of where it goes. And, you know, some of the osteopathic models of this, I think of Fulford's model, where you have these tension reservoirs throughout the body, and some of the fascial models I've read talk about how the body is held together by all these slings. And it would just seem like, I keep going back to this theory, this mindset that there's some intelligence behind this. I don't think of it as an accident that all these things happen, that there is an organization that's overarching it, and I'm came up again today in some of the discussions today at where I was. Don Watson's work in the field of enfermy, informed systems, where you're now coupling, again, you're talking about the environment and shaping the individual. Now you're dealing with the environment on the inside and the outside in informed systems, because it almost works like a Mobius strip in a way, where there's a conservation of organization. That's what enfermy really means. Well, you know, there's conservation of energy and all of that, but this is conservation of organization. So the system has an ability to maintain its organization no matter how complex its environment gets. And an informed system is able to do that coherently without spending a lot of energy to do it. And when you lose enfermy, when you lose that coupling, your system goes into disorganization, which, of course, would lead to, you know, the system going into disintegration. So what do you say to the beat-up population out there listening, you know, that's in their 40s, maybe they've had some minor knee surgery, they've been beat up a little bit, they're loaded with scar tissue, They've got a million habits that that keep them where they are behaviorally. They're basically bleeding tensegrity out of their body. How do you get them to understand that they still have the core pattern resonant and internally that they can actually tap into that? That aging is really it's not a linear process. It's something that they can actually at any age they can begin or basically resume what their body was set up to do. Because I know, like Peter Gaskew's work with chronic pain, he gets these old ladies on the phone that haven't walked in 10, 15 years, and he has them stand up on the radio show and just pigeon-toe their feet and get their pelvis back aligned. And it's like these things are all sort of laying around in the back of the woodshed. So how do you approach that audience that's, they're too old for the Olympics, but they're too young for the boneyard?
Well, what the body's always trying to do is get itself into an energy-efficient position.
Right.
And the most energy-efficient structure is an icosahedron, a tensegrity structure. So what you got to do is try and rebalance the system. And it would be like if you had a spoke on your bicycle wheel that was too tight or too loose, and usually as you get older, they're usually pretty loose on one end and tight on another, and what you're trying to do is rebalance the system. So I tend to use, I always use rhythmic patterned exercises to sort of reset the clock.
Really? Sounds like our use of, we call them simples in our work in the somatic method, where the most basic pattern you learn in locomotion is the cross crawl. And the more you can get that cross crawl to be coupled to breathing, to be coupled to the eye movement, things like that, your body will naturally start to develop more of a coupling, and you'll get more coordinated. Even if you're not naturally coordinated, that induces it. So this is the same mindset of rhythmic exercise, in case people listen to that. It's sort of a newfangled thing. Interval training came out in the 80s, and I don't know, maybe you're familiar with Irving Dardick's work from the Olympics back in the 80s, and he's been working over the last 20 years on his model with it's called superwave theory, which works with our heart rate variability. And you're trying to basically take the system up the superwave, and if you look at the superwave, it's just a lot of nested loops, waves, as he says.
Yeah, those nested waves are reverberations of the icosahedron.
Yeah.
And they start at the cellular level, work their way right up, so that if the heart has its rhythm, and the kidney has its rhythm, and your eyeballs have their rhythm, and you're really a combination of the symphony. You're a symphony of all these different rhythms in your body. And all you have to do is try and get it back in tune.
Now, doesn't that sound metaphysical to say something like that? It doesn't sound like an orthopedic surgeon I know who wants to just give you a shot in the cortisone in your ribs or whatever. Everywhere you hurt, they want to stick you with the cortisone shots. And
yeah,
just get things in rhythm.
Well, you know, as I said, I look at it as purely a mechanical thing, you know.
Right.
It's a mechanical thing and physics, and I see no reason to go past there.
Well, someone that's practicing Tai Chi or someone that's practicing, say, Hatha Yoga, there's definitely an affect that goes with that as a result of putting yourself in that much physical coherence. So just the fact that you're doing it, the payoff is you don't have to go, self-medicate, outside yourself to get that state back, to get that state of buoyancy back, because it's sitting there resonantly, in your system. The fact that it's so physical and on the shelf like a can of soup is almost too good to be true. People think they have to go achieve it or break through some invisible wall. Or guys are talking about enlightenment and middle-aged crises today, and I'm like, why is it always about drawing some invisible line out there in the universe that everyone has to get to? No, it's you're already there. But they keep looking outside for answers and support, and when they look inside, they just see this decaying flesh. They don't see what you're seeing. And that's why, I think most people just, it's like they go inside and someone turn off the lights, and they're disoriented there. What you're suggesting is that there is a I have this image of interlocking clocks, there is a someone's keeping score in there, And if you can just amplify that awareness on the physical level, I mean, it might just be as simple as just postural stuff. And you say you do rhythmic work, and people work on you know, rebounders and things like that too. I've seen different research on that. And the new fangled thing, maybe you know something about this because it's based on Tensegrity too, is these wave boards that like Soloflex has come out with that has a carrier wave in what looks like the old step up aerobics thing, and it puts an electrical signal into your foot and it goes throughout your entire body. And I have an old version of this thing that was not the wave board, but it's called the Body Blade, which looks like a wet noodle. And it works on the principles of plyometrics, which is another thing that takes advantage of Tensegrity. So they used to do rehab, say someone had a shoulder problem. You know, the rehab was very like you do your Cobbett exercises and swing your arm in a pendulum and very linear, very almost like Legos, you know. Your arm wasn't connected to anything but the shoulder. There was nothing else there. And now they have these plyometric things where you're dynamically moving through a range of motion while you're also generating a force that goes through the entire body from the wrist up the elbow, through the whole kinetic chain, so you're re-educating the whole circuit. So now you're not just getting a mechanical a re-education, you're getting a neurological re-education, a muscular re-education, a fascial re-education, even circulation is changing. Do you see that field becoming, that approach becoming the dominant approach in the next 10, 15 years, or is it always going to be the outliers that do it?
I think that there's going to be a quantum change someplace or other, and everybody's going to shift. Because it has to come. At one point, they're going to recognize that the linear lever system it doesn't work, and it's completely wrong. It's a 300-year-old theory that just doesn't fit anymore. So you have to go into modern physics and quantum mechanics, and you're going to get into these rhythms that are there and that are part of the body. And once you learn about that, then you're going to learn that the whole system has to work together. And
yeah, this works again in terms of again, to go back to behavioral for a minute. When you watch mothers phenotypically imprint their child, you know, whether it comes to posture or movement patterns, things like that, the child is observing the mother to learn how to do things. So when you're copying other people's behavior, like when you're learning a dance skill or any kind of specialized skill, you're always at the mercy of the entrainer, of the teacher. And so you embed those patterns into the way you move. So this is one of those things now where you can actually override a lot of, you know, basically poorly learned or badly formed movement patterns by understanding what you're saying is that the system has programmability. It isn't just this machine. It might be mechanistic, but it's not a machine. And that's a tough street to cross after dark, you know. It's, when you say something is mechanistic, it almost like makes it seem like it's lifeless. And you're saying it's full of life.
Yes. Now, you know, it's the kind of a thing is that when you get on a bicycle and try to pedal it, you know that you have to set that seat at just the right height.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hit that height, pedaling becomes easy. Otherwise, you're putting too much energy into the system. So if it's too high or too low, it doesn't fit right. And what you have to... each person has to learn is where that point is in their system. And when they can, and it happens in any rhythmic pattern that you do. So in running, you pick up a particular pace. In swimming, you pick up a particular pace that fits your system. And it's the same thing as adjusting the height on the bicycle seat, finding the right point for you that's the most energy efficient. So that in all these things, once you start learning that that's what you have to do, then you begin to put that into whatever you are doing, and you get a rhythm in your life that fits.
Yeah, and we talk about that in our work in the Somatic Method as well, that there's four basic social rhythms that we entrain. We do that during development. The most predominant one is the one that you're speaking about, is the smooth rhythm of the philo-somatic, which is basically a sine wave that allows the system to get a clear channel to perceive more information. So it's a very basic pattern. And actually, you're a member of that tribe. You'd be profiled as a philo in our model. So the system is always seeking that smooth channel. It can't handle a lot of noise. It needs the pure signal. And then when you get into a vertical way of perceiving where you're referencing yourself, it's more of the spike pattern, which would be like an action potential or a spike train in the brain where you're getting beta waves in the brain. You're getting big-time thinking and the surges kind of. And then those two combine, and you get the staccato rhythm, which is the emotional pattern, and then it finally squares off in the exo pattern, which is more, you know, more the embedding of mechanical things like you're talking about here. So those four basic rhythms, inside of the fact that you're dealing with other things, like you're talking about sleep wake and circadian rhythms and lunar rhythms. We love all that stuff in this thing. And only thing, the only difference between me and you, or the three of our models, is that I'm a woo and you're a moo. And at the end of the day, I like the fact that there's a metaphysical little piece of candy inside all this stuff. Otherwise, it's like when I talk to the scientists about fractals. If they weren't aesthetically pleasing to look at, hardly anyone would have took the time to do the time series on them to see why they exist. You seem to be okay with, you know, I don't want any prize inside. I'm content to know that this thing is there, and I can study it. I can study it on different scales, and it keeps showing up, and it's reliable and reproducible, and it seems to be universal for what we can tell. You know, so I guess, you know, kind of close up shop on us here. This had to affect your perception of the healing process in general. How did it affect you personally? I mean, if you're walking around on planet Earth, you absorb some shocks, and like you said, some sides are too tight. The spokes are a little different. Knowing that you're a tensegrity structure yourself, I can't even say that, Katrahedron, sounds like a flavor at one of these Chipotle places around here. How has that affected your self-perception, where maybe you'd be in the mindset of, okay, I'm old, I'm supposed to have this happen to me, or I'm not young anymore. People, that language is pervasive, and you seem to be able to transcend it perceiving others. How does that work perceiving yourself?
It's just part of what I am and what I do. I just recognize that I do certain things better than others, and I work on those things, and I'm, you know, I'm content to work in my rhythms.
Yeah, and it, like I said, it sounds like it's an easy rhythm to carry because it's very, it's light. Other people explain tensegrity to me, and they really made it very difficult to know, because it's wrapped up in a lot of ratios and a lot of like really, really dry stuff. And you read Stephen's work, and you go to biotensegrity.com, he's got articles up there he's published, he's got other people, other resources. It's really a great kind of a grand central station for all thoughts, tensegrity-wise and otherwise. And he writes very long and very, elaborate responses to people. When because there's a lot of debates, like anything in math and physics, I mean, they'll fight to the end of time about, you know, what's pressure versus load and friction. And for me, as a reader, you make these things come to life, because it's hard to get excited about how a tire hits the road and if it's compressing into the ground or if it's actually, you know, absorbing the shock. You make this real, because your analogies are extremely real world, and they have a sense of, you know, portability to them, whereas some of the other stuff I've read, even the stuff that's in my field, they make it, like I said, it seems mechanistic, and that reads to me as being lifeless, where your stuff seems to be more dynamical, and it has a quality of openness to it, where it's not a closed system. It's a system that's able to open and close and be aware of itself on the inside and the outside. So for that, I thank you, because we need people writing about tensegrity that have a little bit of soul, even if they don't want to call it a soul. Because otherwise, it just, like I said, it just reads like a lot of dry mechanistic stuff that doesn't really have a lot of, you know, a lot of juice to it. So keep writing it, and I'll keep writing my stuff on the baseball sites, and, you know, maybe our paths will cross again. And you know, is there one thing before you go that people just still don't get about what you're saying that you'd like to just kind of clear up in a paragraph or two for us? What's the one stumbling block they have out there in grasping this thing?
Well, it's that, you know, we've just been brought up on building blocks, stacking one on top of the other, and you have to start thinking in broader terms. You know, you just can't move one joint in your spine, and you can't move just one muscle in your body. And they're all interconnected structures, and you're right that the mind gets involved in it, because, you know, we are biochemical structures. But most of biochemistry is physical. So we are physical manifestations of life, that's all. And I think we have to accept it and work with it.
Well, like I said, you've cleared a big path in the with your your work is like a intellectual sickle out there, because there's a lot of people just propagating the old model and confusing people out of their minds. And as soon as you're injured, boy, does your map become important, because if you think of you're naming every part of your body, shoulder, hip, knee, and they're all separate, what connects them? That push-pulley model is not going to work.
You know, if a quarterback gets a turf toe, he can't throw the ball very well.
Right.
And when, you know, a golfer hurts his knee, he can't swing a golf club, because the whole system has to be integrated into one.
Yeah, like I said, I think for the most part, it's a humbling. Your first lesson into integrity is usually, ow. And then you go, oh, okay, everything's connected here. So it's like, you know, even you could be, the best goalie in hockey, and if you have a toothache, you're not moving around too well that night. So everything is connected. That's 206 bones, 645 muscles, 43 miles of blood vessels, breathing 25,000 times a day, hurtling through space. So it's like, you know, people want to make it all static, and I think because of that, they take the life out of it because they don't allow it to be as natural as it really is. And I think we're kind of cut off from nature in that respect, and you're opening the door to return us to nature. So I thank you for that, and thanks for joining us here in summertime. I hope you had a good time with us here.
Well, yeah, I did, and thank you for having me, and good night.
All right, take care now.
Thanks.
All right,
night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Well, here he goes.
Ba-dee-da. You're opening the door to return us to nature. So I thank you for that, and thanks for joining us here.
What happened there? You're like feedback. I guess the archive started early.
God.
Ba-dee-da, ba-dee-da.
I just had a sneezing fit.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
What were you saying?
I just had a sneezing fit.
Off the air, though. We couldn't, because last week my coughing fit was on the air. I'm going to go back and record that. That was the best.
That's tomorrow. And that is it for us today.
Okay. So anyway, let's see if my thing made it here. I didn't know where I put it. It is under... There it is, disorder. Okay. Oh, and the keyboard. The thing goes... As soon as I get my stupid... Having a Mac is like basically having nothing.
I hate this thing.
Oh, I hate this thing. It's got... Like, you know what? Normally in a PC, you open a tab, and ooh, look, and everything opens up in the same browser. Well, in this thing, if you do that, it clicks out because you overlapped. You know how much stuff I lost last night? Oh, forget about it. Forget about it. Can't make it tonight. Shout out to... My little buddy out there is struggling to get his body back in order, searching for his tensegrity maps as we speak, Clato Sr. Fonte. I'll be home Saturday. I'll be dealing with my karma and Sue Karma soon. So, you know, tomorrow is Soma Day. I will, share what happened with that next week. We have someone coming on next week talking about recovery, another great topic that the SAPES out here are into, and... hopefully we're going to get into a little woo. We've had a kind of a woo fast for a while here, and I want to get back into that a little bit because, it's getting to the point where I need a little woo. And you need a little Christmas, you need a little woo. You know? We've been very moo for a while. So, all right, any last thoughts? Or you just basically have another thought in an hour? That was a good interview. I don't know. You don't like it, but to me, explain.
You know what? It's not my thing. It was interesting at times, but I think I'm just too damn tired to try to process something that I don't know. You know, just the learning thing is just not going to happen at night.
Ouch! I'm thinking. So you're the host of the show, and you have a hard time learning anything from listening to it during a show. Okay.
Yeah, but that's directly related to having. Been working for a million hours today and just being just too tired to focus.
You're talking like a judo. What's up? There she goes again, buddy.
That's right.
Well, this thing is going to do it. Is it resetting ever again? All right, hang on a second here. All right, so anyway, I will be sliding back east reluctantly on Friday afternoon.
Reluctantly? How nice.
Very reluctant. Oh, God, kicking the screen. Well, you know what it's like when you're in traffic and you turn to your head to the right and you see this mountain? I mean,
I've
people probably don't even notice it.
No, of course not.
No.
I have mountains here.
No, you got nothing there. You know what you got there, Drek? You got a Drek city. It's ugly, but ugly, and it's getting uglier.
What's ugly?
The entire New York City metropolitan area is a ugly structure. Yes,
no,
it is.
No, it's not. I've got all kinds of beautiful things up here.
I've got
farmland. I've got mountains.
Farm?
You're
in the boondocks. I'm talking about New York City. Where you live, basically, is you and the scarecrow and the coyote and whatever. I don't even count that. You're living in the Ozarks. You might as well be living in Canada.
It's nice.
Yeah, you love it.
I can't stand going to Westchester now.
Yeah, I told you, because like I said, the more you get close to the city, the more it just gets ugly. There's nothing good to look at. At least
well,
not the traffic on 25. I look over, I see the mountains, I'm happy.
I don't know if it's ugly, but it's traffic-y, and I can't stand it.
Happiness is defined as going 85 miles an hour in your rent-a car to the Leonard Skinner's The Breeze while you're 2 hours late for your conference.
Oh, God. So what kind of rental car did you get?
Oh, that's the thing. I got upgrade. Let me upgrade you. Now I got to fight with them about the price, but basically they made me pay $40 for the gas up front. They don't have to fill it up anymore. But then they proceeded to charge me for the upgrade after I didn't ask for one. So they're going to be a fight. But it's a big SUV. I can't remember the name of it. It is a monster car. I get in this thing, I thought I was driving from the top of the world. It was amazing. And it drives smooth as silk. And it's got,
you
can put different radio stations on different sides of the car. It's got, like, three DVD players. There's nobody in the back. And it's very strange. But anyway, for 3 days, I'm driving like I own something. And, of course, I got no insurance. So stay away from me for the next 2 days.
Oh, my God.
Yes, because I wouldn't not be eco if I didn't take the risk.
Are just so bad.
They tried to sell me everything on the way out of there. I was there an hour in the budget.
You gotta take the insurance.
No, I got my own insurance to cover. They don't need their crap. And the other thing is that they try to sell you a GPS thing for 10 bucks a day. Then they want to sell you something else for
$30
a day. No way. I don't need a GPS. It's one road, Denver, 25, north or south. Where are you going? That's it. Everything else leads to 25. You know, if you're not at 25, you're not in Denver. You're leaving Denver.
Now, when I was in Denver, I stayed at the Excalibur, which was a pretty cool hotel.
Yeah.
And I ran into the Vikings there, actually.
The Minnesota Vikings, not Leif Erickson and his leftover crew. Okay.
Right.
Oh, the one thing I did find here that you'd be of interest, remember our friend Al Swergen from...
Yes.
Do you know he died in Denver?
I did not.
Running for the train with his gold. Someone shot him.
Right there, huh?
Yeah, because...
Do they have a monument to him?
They have a little plaque.
Did you take a picture?
I have no camera.
Oh, get a disposable, will you?
I have no camera. No.
There's a lot
of train history with Denver. You know, the gold rush and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So this came up in discussions, and I was talking about Deadwood, and he goes, Al Swergen was shot right on that corner. I'm like, what? Al Swergen? Where is Al? Here we go. There's Al's quote about it. We're talking about vitalistic stuff tonight, so we'll give you this one.
I don't want to talk to these cocksuckers, but you have to. In life, you have to do a lot of things you don't fucking want to do. Many times, that's what the fuck life is, one vile fucking task after another. But don't get aggravated. Then the enemy has you by the short hair.
Oh, and I'd love to hang out with that guy.
Me too. Come on, you got to borrow a camera from your sister. She's Philo. She must have five of them.
If I find one. I'm definitely going to try to take a picture of my stupid poster, because that thing is like that
well,
old
yes.
dementia.
You really need to do that.
I got
to
get that on the web, because that was, everybody else was black and white. This is what I found out about this, these poster things. You make your poster in a PDF on your computer, right, and then you go to Kinko's, and for $20, they blow it up 3 feet by 4 feet in one big sheet.
Mm.
And it's clear as day. Now, if you go color, it costs like $100. But if you go black and white, it's like $20. See, then you print out with the color printer, you print out small versions of it as an 8.5 by 11 to hand to your safes. So everyone has a color map to go home with, and they have the big black and white one to look at on the poster board. If you're doing a workshop where there's no PowerPoint, no web, no nothing, like we were like Gilligan's Island today. But to me it was worthwhile because I got to bounce some ideas off these people's heads, and they, you know, they were very, what's the word? Al dente in terms of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't hard-headed.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Almost. Oh, this is my sister Donna. You're gonna be. We're 5 minutes. We're off the air, and then we can have the computer for. I gotta eat. I'm on the air. You're on the air right now. That's nice. Well, you came in and told me to get there. We're talking on the phone. Shaking her head. She's now strangling somebody. Okay. Well, smoothing under the covers. That's right. All right. Denver's getting the best of me, so I'm going to give you this to ease us out. Let's cover the theme song. I like the energy.
Hey!
Did you leave?
No.
What the hell? You didn't say anything when I asked you.
What did you ask me?
Are you there?
Did you ask me that over the screaming music in my ear?
It's because I was going to start the music and we can't chat because we're dysfunctional.
Well, I didn't hear a damn thing.
All right. Well, I'll start nice and slow. See, here you go. At 25. See, then we can still call. I like the energy.
Hey.
I like the frig organ.
Disorder in the house. The turf.
All right, I'm done trying to talk to Val. So, I will see you next week at 9 o'clock, back on the East Coast time. Enjoy the music and travel light, everybody. I know I will.
And cover.
Now, in there, please.
Helicopters hover over rough terrain. Disorder in the house. Reptile wisdom. Zombies all along. Every round. Disorder in the house. There's a flaw in the system. And the fly.
Nothing. I'm going to go to a plane, come home, get my brains beat in like I normally do. Oh. All right, everybody. Travel Life. We'll see you next week. Hope you enjoyed the show. Archive and spread the word. Some days tomorrow I'll be there or just forget about it.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, right. All right. See you later, everybody.
Bye.